Welcome inside 254. Let's close the office door and start the conversation. Join us for our first fundraising event at 12:30 on Saturday, June 17th. We'll have yoga, wine, and games at Shine Yoga Center in Perkasie, Pennsylvania. Start with a 45-minute yoga class with Inside 254 co-host Colleen, enjoy a glass of wine, and play Pin the Cafeve on Trump. Support Inside 254. Visit our Facebook page to RSVP. Starts at 12:30 on June 17th. See you there!
Did you ever want it? Did you want it back? Oh, my.
This week's talk around the table is about HBO's miniseries Big Little Lies, which was super popular, and we're gonna have a lot of spoilers. So if you have not watched it yet, please, if you plan on watching it, stop now and walk away and come back to your Podbean or iTunes in a few weeks when you're done.
Yeah, watch the show first.
Yes.
We are going to spoil, so just...
Because we're immediately going to talk about the end, basically. Yeah. So, Amanda, what did you think of the show?
I actually loved it. I thought it was suspenseful. I didn't know who died until the very last until the very last moment of the last episode. I thought, okay, well, it's got to be one of them standing at the top of the stairs, but I wasn't sure who. And then at the end of the last episode, when it was, and I don't know the character's name, when it was Nicole Kidman's husband,
Celeste.
Yeah. When it was her husband, and they were having that moment where they all realized who he actually was.
Harry,
I was like, oh my God. And then
lying there dead.
Oh my God. And then when Bonnie came running out of nowhere after and just pushed out, I gasped at the end. So I loved it for the fact that it kept me in suspense. I'm usually really good at figuring out like who done it or who died or who's the
dead.
Who dat? Like, I'm usually really good at, I mean, being a former English major, right? I'm really good at reading these stories and figuring out. This one kept me guessing the entire time. And I loved the complexity of the characters, especially the women, because I think in a story like this, it would be real easy to have this two-dimensionality to it. And I don't know if it was Leanne Moriarty who wrote the original novel, or whether it was the screenwriters, or maybe it was the women who were playing these roles, or maybe a combination of all, but they really seemed to complicate. Every time you thought one of them women was a complete asshole, she does something that makes you realize, wow, like everyone's story is more complicated than you realize, which is something that we say even in real life. So I like the complexity there. I just really enjoyed it as a story. I mean, I really looked forward to seeing it. I liked the music. I liked how the music and the imagery and the visuals and the characters and the scenes, how it all built up and how it all worked together. I thought it was just a really well done series. I kind of don't want to read the book either, because I feel like
I have no interest in
this. Is one of
book.
Those yeah. This is one of those stories to me where, you know, we usually say the book is always better than the movie. Not always. And I feel like this, I don't, not to,
it might be,
it might be, but I feel like I got,
it's
a
not
lot
a book
this.
I would have read.
No, it's not a
you
book
know,
I
think
read either.
To be fair, no. It's not a book that I would probably would have picked up and read.
No.
And I heard it was great. And I know my friends who did read it loved it. It's just not something I would normally read.
No. A couple of things that sort of struck me as I was watching it is sort of, again, the complexity of these relationships, the representation of these women. And I kept thinking representation. And the one thing that sort of ticked in the back of my head constantly was the problem I had with it is that this is a group of white, wealthy, privileged people, mostly white, and in a wealthy, privileged community. I keep thinking about who's the audience for this
Me,
story?
You. Yeah.
Like, who's the audience for this story? And is this really truly, it's not really truly equally representational of all situations. I mean, you talk about a white, wealthy, mostly white, wealthy, privileged community and the people in it. Does it really represent the complexity of humanity? I don't know. My initial reaction was, well, yes, it does, because there's all these different layers to these characters, and yet I keep coming back to the sort of the non-complexity of the community and the foundation from which the story begins. So I really liked it. I liked it. But so, I think there are complications in it.
So the one thing I tell my students all the time is that I am able to derive pleasure from something even if I think it's problematic. And I think this series is a perfect example of that, that I could feel satisfied in ways, but also really find some of it problematic. So
did you like it?
No.
You see, I think this is one of the things. Well, we don't agree on everything, and this is one of those.
I think it's because everybody thought I was going to like it so much because of the end, which I'll talk about in a second. But first, I want to problematize the privilege, because that was the thing that was really the sticking point for me that I could not get away from when it was offered as, and I could read this two ways. When the therapist offers the idea of you need to get an apartment and have it ready and have it stacked with food. I have worked with women fleeing domestic violence situations before. This is not accessible for most people. So I can watch that and go, oh, the way that smacks of privilege was really hard for me to swallow. Mm-hmm. Now I could flip that and maybe try to be more positive and talk about how, yes, she does have access to all these things, but yet she still isn't able to leave. To talk about the insidious mm-hmm. nature of abuse and how it seeps into even people within a socioeconomic status of privilege. And I think it's even harder sometimes for people to believe that people in those socioeconomic status classes are abused. Mm-hmm. So I could look at it two ways. I find myself leaning toward the first, where it says, well, that's a little easy. It's not easy, but that's not something that's available. That right. whole apartment thing
yeah.
got me. And I think everybody thought I was going to love it because of the ending. And so people who know
the women on the beach, right. the women so, coming together.
Yeah. yeah. So I teach a course and have always investigated protagonists who are violent. Yes, there is something that feels very satisfying about watching Bonnie throw him down the steps. Mm-hmm. And we have this dramatic scene of women trying to protect another woman, and he's lashing out at all of them. He's been violent to all of them, either in that moment or in the past, because we know that we find out in the moment that he is the rapist that the Shailene Woodley character has been looking for. Right. So in that moment, it feels satisfying. And then we have the scene of the community at the end, the female community with the children. And I love the title of one of the episodes about serious mothering. Mm-hmm. However, what I leave this show with is again an example of how all social systems have failed the women, even rich white women who have a community. The structures that are supposed to be in place to protect those women's fail them, whether it's because of social stigma or because of policing. So again, we have this trope of vigilante justice is the only justice that is available to women. So when I continue to walk away from that, yes, personally, I feel satisfied, but individually, I feel satisfied, but structurally, I feel frustrated. Yeah. And so many of the texts that I leave from and that I teach leave me feeling that way, where, God damn it, why can't something work for women within something that is prescribed as opposed to vigilante? It just felt like a lot of the books that I teach, where women are failed by systems, they have to take it into their own hands. And even in this community of rich white women, mm-hmm. nothing is there. And I know she's silenced, and I know maybe she could have spoken up, but she does, I think, at the end yeah. when she's telling Renata, and the women come together. But is that really the only thing that is available for women? And so when I leave these parables, I get really frustrated, because I want to see one where the guy just like gets locked up and everybody believes her. But we never see that. Nobody would believe her. She doesn't believe it herself. There are all these tentacles and insidiousness of abuse and misogyny. And then they come together at the end and they all apologize to each other and then they protect each other. So yes, that makes me feel good. But at the same time, it makes me feel really deeply sad.
Yeah, because they have to lie to protect themselves.
Exactly.
Right? It's that idea that, well, because we don't believe women.
They have no other choice.
There's no other choice, right? So I definitely hear you. And I know these are going to be a couple of big questions, and they're too big to go into just in this table talk. But I do have a couple questions. Does this pass the Bechdel test? Does it involve two named women characters who talk about something other than men?
Yes. Rape.
Right, which is what I'm saying, like, right, I'm thinking like, about
that's another trope.
All the conversations that they have at the coffee shop, at the school, I mean, I guess you could say when they're talking about their kids.
They talk about mothering. Yeah.
They talk about mothering. Yeah. They talk about their kids. The Reese Witherspoon character is trying to get that show off the ground, a community
Madeline,
theater.
That's true. Right? The Avenue Q stuff. She's
different.
Dedicated to art and she wants to do this.
And Renata's like fighting her on it. So there's that whole infight. So, but there are conversations.
It does. In my mind, it passes the Bechdel.
It passes. Yeah. And then the other bigger question is this a feminist series? And I have to say, I don't, and here's the thing, I'm not going to actually provide a direct answer to this, because to me it's a too big of a question, but I think it's worth at least a little bit of grappling with.
Yes.
I think maybe yes and no. I know. I know, right? It
sounds
like
fair.
I'm totally copping out because I want to say
you want it to
yes.
be, but it's not.
You want it to be.
Personally and individually, you want it to be,
because
but it's
I'm
not.
But I'm thinking about the women and their friendships, the complexity of them, how they come together, the complex nature of how at least some of the male characters are presented as, you know, they are allowed humanity and complexity too. I think about, you know, the representations of mothers, of men, of community, of the values and who has privilege and who doesn't. I mean, I really, really want to say yes, it's a feminist series, but something is keeping me from saying yes. And I don't know if it's because
intersectionality
of the class.
Is what keeps you from
because there's
yes.
no, I mean, even Bonnie, she's the African American character, but again, like you said earlier, why is she with him? Well, we understand why he's with her. Why is she with him?
I have no idea.
And I don't, was it just a casting thing? Or is it just, I mean, I don't know. But there's no intersection of anything. There's no class. There's no race. There's no ethnicity.
Except for
there's
the black police officer.
A black police officer who doesn't believe them.
Right.
Rightly so. Because she knows they're lying.
And she's pissed at the level of privilege they have that they're going to get away with it.
And she says at the end, when she's watching them in silence behind that glass where she's watching them all give their testimony, she says it's their language. Because the Nicole Kidman character,
Celeste,
is a lawyer. And at that moment where she and Bonnie are sort of talking very quietly before the cops come down.
Yep.
I really feel like she was telling her, this is what you say. We have to say this.
She's absolutely, yeah.
She was the one that coordinated to protect them all. She's the one with the language. She's the one with the legal education and knowledge to be able to know what to say to the cops to make sure all of this goes away.
But it's upsetting that they can only have female community in that moment of violence. Now, I know right before they all apologize.
So I really want to say it's feminist, but I can't. I stopped short.
Don't get to be the arbiters of feminism.
No.
And perhaps it's not even a productive question, but it's fun to talk about, right? And it gives us something to think about. Yeah. And I don't know. If feminism is about representation, no. If feminism is about agency, perhaps. Mm. So this is where I always get stuck. Mm-hmm. And this is where I get stuck in the books I teach. Like, everybody should read Foxfire by Joyce Carol Oates, right? It's, again, this kind of parable about when social structures fail women and what they do within it. But in this story, capitalism is totally fine for all these women.
It is.
And so they are all benefiting from capitalism. Like,
they are not
Marxist
feminists.
But like, when I get stressed out, I can't like just go for a glass of wine because I have a nanny, or go out on my deck and look at the ocean. Like, it's hard when I don't see myself in the characters. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that it means I'm incapable of having empathy, but it's just, if feminism is about representation, to me, that show was not. Now, again, I still watched all of it. I still got some pleasure out of it. I don't think it was a waste of my time. I didn't like it, I think, as much as everybody thought I was going to like it, because I don't like stories about vigilantism, because they mean that everything else structurally is failing women.
Good point. Other questions that arose for me are, is there anything that sort of the audience, the viewers, the people who watch this series, is there anything we should beware of? Or be wary of? And then, is there anything positive to take away from this?
I think the positive part for me was the representations of mothering and the ferocity of mothering. Like I said to you when we were rewatching the end, that party is my worst nightmare. Right. Like, the last thing I would ever want to do, and this is why my daughter goes to a Quaker school, because I hate competition, it would be competing parents. And this is very real in circles of mothering. Like, who's the best mother? Who's doing this? Who's making this food? And Renata really feels that because she's working outside the home, and she's powerful, and she really feels like people think she's a shrew and a bitch, and maybe she is, right? And so I liked all those negotiations and maneuverings.
Yeah. So the positive thing for me was, again, the representations of the women's friendships and how complex and ultimately caring they ended up being, even though there's rivalries and there's problems and things like that. In the end, they all do come together. When it comes down to... Right. In this case,
but
like,
why does the shit have to come down?
I know.
Why can't we have those communities before the shit comes down?
And I get that, and I hear you, but I feel like this is a series that represents the complexity of women's friendships in a way that is accessible and
dirty.
And a little more honest than what a lot of shows and representations. So I liked that sort of messiness. Again, I'm always saying, like, embrace the mess.
Yeah.
I think... even despite the structural problems, which I definitely see your point. I think that's the positive thing, is this complexity of women's friendships with all the mess that it is involved. But when the shit hits the fan, women, we can be there for each other. We can be that community that supports and helps and protects.
I think it's totally worth watching.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I watched it. And I think it is an opportunity of shared viewership that lots of people can have great conversations about.
And what about anything that we should be wary of? Because I brought up the issue of the class thing. Like, be aware when you watch this that this is a very specific subject position for these characters. So be aware that this is not everybody's... I know it's a fiction story,
I think really people need to be wary of triggering. And I think people need to be wary of tropes about women who are raped. And I am very appreciative of how they did it in this show. I thought it did a good job that it shows her, like, moving on, having her son, loving her son, not complicating that too much.
And Shailene Woodley's character with all the dreams that she has about her
I liked Jane. I liked how gritty she was. Mm-hmm. I could never quite understand how she could have afforded to move into that community. So there were some moments where I was like, she couldn't be here. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we always need to be wary when rape is a mode of moving storyline. I always want us to be careful about that. I thought it did well with that she loved her son, she wanted to protect her son, and so it did a good job. But we should always be careful about that. Like, when Downton Abbey had a rape in it, I was like, come on, really? Like, come. I think Rebecca Traister wrote a great article about that. Like, I'm out. You did not need to have rape as part of this storyline.
Yeah, it was this fine one, by itself. This one is a little central.
It needed to be in there, and it brings them together. Yeah. And I like that at the end we have all the, you know, these half siblings running around, and they don't know that they're half siblings. So it ends with something beautiful, but I struggle really hard with trauma.
But again, it's like, but for that, women, like, does that always have to be the case?
I hate that. Like, I hate that you have to, like, rise like a phoenix out of your trauma and be a better person. Like, again,
Why does it always have to be that?
To require trauma in order for that to happen.
So maybe people need to be wary of sort of expecting that. That is a societal expectation for women, is we are only allowed to rise when we suffer trauma. We should just rise because we're awesome.
Right.
Right.
We shouldn't have to be responding and reactive to something that has happened to us in order to have agency and power.
So that storyline sort of just reifies that.
Yeah. I worry about that. But it does do a good job of complicating it if you sit and watch the 8 hours.
And it is engaging.
If you listen to us.
And it's engaging. And
oh, it's beautiful. And it's
beautifully shot.
And it's well gorgeously acted. I mean, I'm not going to take away any of that stuff. No.
But think about it when you watch it, or if you already watched it. Hopefully we didn't completely spoil it for you, but when you watch
it, we warned you
when you watch it, just, you know, be thoughtful, think about what you're actually seeing, and think about some of the complications that we've brought
up. That's all I'm asking.
Time for Trumpster Fire.
Amanda,
yes,
I'm worried about the VAWA.
And what is VAWA?
The Violence Against Women Act.
Ah, 1994?
That was when it began, and it was reauthorized in 2013. That added some really important protections for services and justice that were done to specific communities, such as Native American women, LGBT survivors,
So why are we talking about this on Trumpster Fire?
Well, we're talking about VAWA because according to The Hill, some of the members of Trump's transition team have been talking about reducing federal spending using a blueprint from the Heritage Foundation. And I'm going to quote from the Heritage Foundation's Blueprint for Balance for the federal budget for 2017.
Okay.
They say that they have a whole page, page 24, Eliminate Violence Against Women Act grants. Their recommendation is to eliminate VAWA grants and try to save the government $480 million this fiscal year. And they say that these grants should be terminated because they should be funded and implemented locally. That's fine if that were to actually happen, but federally, we are guaranteed then that these crisis centers and hotlines are funded. And they argue, the Heritage Foundation, that using federal agencies to fund the routine operations of domestic violence programs that state and local governments could provide is a misuse of federal resources and a distraction from concerns that are truly the province of federal government.
Insert eye roll emoji.
So there's more on this page, and I would encourage you all to check it out.
What's the website?
It is, I will link it onto our web. Okay. It is the Heritage Foundation's Blueprint for Balance. It's a PDF. That women's safety is a distraction from really what the government should do is where I get worried. So I'm a little worried about VAWA and what's going to happen.
I wonder, though, if it's actually going to, if the funding will actually be eliminated, because I found this letter on Senator Chuck Grassley's webpage. It's grassley.senate.gov. And he's a Republican senator from Iowa. But he and along, it's a bipartisan group of senators, includes Grassley, Dean Heller, Republican from Nevada, Jean Shaheen, Democrat from New Hampshire, Susan Collins, Republican from Maine, Dianne Feinstein, Democrat from New York, Shelley Moore Capito, Republican from West Virginia, and Bob Casey, our guy in Pennsylvania. And they wrote this letter supporting the ACT programs that you're talking about, like the Heritage Foundation wants to cut, supporting it in Trump's federal budget request. And if you go to grassley.senate.gov, you can actually look at it in his news release section. But this is just a section of this bipartisan letter. We encourage this administration to again partner with Congress to champion critical VAWA programs aimed at preventing abuse, improving the law enforcement response to violence against women and children, and supporting survivors of domestic and sexual violence. Now more than ever, it is imperative that we support victims and survivors by investing in VAWA to ensure their service providers and law enforcement personnel are equipped with the necessary tools to protect victims and to bring perpetrators of domestic and sexual violence to justice. It's a concern that it's on the
disconnect in the language. I mean, between misuse and distraction,
and investing,
and your language there
is, it's very different.
Oh,
so,
my gosh.
But this is bipartisan, and this is the thing. It's not just Democrats. It's Republican senators who are supporting this, too. So maybe this is where the Republican Party can sort of rubber hit the road and sort of have that line of, we're not going to accept the cutting of this type of program.
I mean, hopefully. We got to watch. We end all of these with, we have to watch. We have to wait and see. People are worried. Trump is informed by this Heritage Foundation. A lot of his other budget cuts have been coming directly from language that comes from that. So when we have this document that says that the VAWA is a misuse and a distraction, I'm not sure exactly what the federal government is supposed to be doing and funding, but it seems to me that the basic safety of citizens should be a priority, not a distraction.
So let's watch and see what actually happens.
Let's see what happens with the budget. Like what you're hearing? Hey Podbean listeners, see that green Become a Patron button at the top right of your screen? You can click on that, donate $1 a month, and get a cool sticker, a Facebook shout out, and our undying gratitude. iTunes listeners, we didn't forget about you. If you go to our Facebook page, you'll see a blue Shop Now button. Click that button and it'll get you to that same site. Thanks for keeping us sustainable.
Let's take a time out for a media minute.
Mm-hmm. For this media minute, I want to point you to two websites that I think are really good resources. I was looking for stories, domestic violence survivor stories, and I found so much more at these two sites. I think these sites are great places to find survivor stories as well as really good information on things like healthy relationships, the relationship spectrum, different resources, the idea of trust, consent, equality, the definitions of different types of abuse, how to get help, how to get involved. So the first one is the National Domestic Violence Hotline, and the website is thehotline.org. It has some really great stories on here where women are sharing their firsthand experiences, and you might see yourself in them, or maybe a friend, or maybe just to know what it looks like, you know, what domestic violence looks like. This could be a great way to sort of learn about it. And also domesticshelters.org. I found this as I was sort of looking for places where I could find stories. And they do have lists of fiction and nonfiction books that they recommend with domestic violence as one of the themes. But the website itself is pretty awesome. They have a data center with infographics, state summaries. There's a resource tab with assessment tools, national and global groups, online forums and chats, different topics. They have, you know, Ask Amanda, which is not me, different Amanda, different sections on childhood domestic violence, children and teens, escaping violence, financial, health, heroes, housing, human trafficking, identifying abuse, relationships, safety planning, and survivor stories, as well as much more. This just seems like a really great place to learn about domestic violence. Like right now up on their site, the top stories are Ask Amanda, Is My Friend in Danger? Can I Kiss You? Is another one. 20 Diversion Tactics Highly Manipulative Narcissists, Sociopaths, and Psychopaths Use, a survivor story. And then there's here called Healthy, Unhealthy, or Abusive. It's a toolkit that they have that you can look for, and a section called When 911 Can't Find You. There's great resources and stories at both of these sites, domesticshelters.org and the National Domestic Violence Hotline. Good place for stories and information. I recommend.
Let's end today's podcast with some activist actions.
The cycle of abuse relies upon those of us not in an abusive situation not believing the person is being abused. So what that means is the best way that you can be an activist to help people in an abusive relationship or situation is to believe that person. There are some other specific things you can do as an activist to help people in an abusive situation. You can talk with them and let that person know that you're concerned about their safety and be supportive. What I've seen so often in all of the work that I have done in the past 20 years supporting people who are in a domestic abuse situation is that people, we on the other side, on that activist side, want to rescue someone. And what I learned as an activist was the empowerment model. How do we instead empower that person to leave? So you will never, quote unquote, rescue somebody. But what you can do is tangible things like offer specific help, offer childcare, offer to take pictures of the person's abuse, offer to get groceries, be there tangibly, and that you will never, ever, ever, ever rescue your friend. You can be supportive. You can help your friend make a safety plan. You can be there for that person. And that is what you do as an activist. You be there and you show up and you believe, and you will never rescue. So when we let go of that idea of rescuing, I think we can actually be an ally in the fight against partner and domestic abuse. Thanks for spending time with us inside 254. You can find us a lot of places online. You can follow us on Facebook at Inside 254 Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Inside 254 Pod. Instagram, we're at Inside 254. And we're online, where we put links and more information from each episode at Inside 254 site, site.wordpress.com. You can follow us on Podbean, and please rate us on iTunes. Thanks for spending time with us this episode of Inside 254.